Hey, Dick, this is Jennifer. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
You're welcome. I just saw your note. We're waiting for the students. I saw three of them, I think. Johanna,
we're
hi.
Just meeting on the table. Oh, sorry.
Natalie, hi. Got us on Miles here, too. Here comes Rhythm. Miles, are you on? There he is. Hi, Rhythm.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you? Staying warm?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Yes, trying to stay warm.
Well, we've got four of the five here, so I'm going to go ahead and welcome everybody to Grad 592. This has been an interesting semester in doing this by Zoom. We like to have it in person so the students and anybody else can meet the speakers, but this seems to be working just as well for now. A reminder to the students that interrupt the speaker if you have a question. He or I will stop every now and then just to make sure if you have questions, they get answered. For the rest of the group, I'd like to kind of hold those questions until the end. Our speaker tonight is Brad Udall. I was going to say infamous Brad, but I didn't know if you'd be insulted or not. Brad and I have worked together in so many different capacities. And Brad is a scientist, and he is now the senior scientist and policy person at the Colorado Water Center. Brad has worked on climate issues forever. And the thing about Brad, and you don't find this in a lot of scientists, but Brad can explain things to you in a very clear and concise manner. And I've watched him in front of crowds that don't believe in climate change, and he still is able to get his message across that things are happening and we need to do something about it. And so, Brad, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'm going to turn it over to you. And you're on mute. There you go.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Jennifer. I was just trying to find my unmute button. Well, thanks for joining me, everybody. And yeah, students, wake up. Does everybody a favor. Share my screen here. My talk title is Climate Change is Water Change. How's the Colorado River Changing? And what are water managers doing to adapt? And this image here comes out of an article in the Washington Post that appeared in early August. If you're familiar with Colorado, this is an iconic dam. I think it's actually the largest diversion, water diversion in the state. It's just east of Grand Junction. It's known as the Roller Dam. And part of my talk here is about this article that appeared again in August and talked about a big warming spot. And before I start and provide you with an outline of where I'm going to go, I have three or four introductory slides that are appropriate given the fires and the drought. This is an image out of NOAA, and I want to concentrate on the upper left and lower right here. And this is the July to September 2020 period relative to 126 years of data. So in the upper left, we've got basically the record warmest, the 126th warmest out of 26 years in Southwest in those two big chunks there of states. And in the lower right, you've got record dry, number one dry out of that same period. And both of these images go a long way to explaining fires and the drought that we've experienced this year. The next image I want to show is here, a nice article that appeared in the Colorado Sun and put this fire season in context. And that circle there, 60 fires that have burned more than 10,000 acres since 2000. And if you look in red, that 2020, now the largest burn in Colorado history at 625,000 or more than that acres. You can see Pine Gulch and Cameron Peak and East Trouble there relative to some of these other really big fire seasons. And later in the talk, I'll just talk a little bit about why fire is so important for water, right? Teddy Roosevelt set aside 100 million acres back at the turn of the 20th century to protect our watersheds. Because back then, as we now know as well, if you have unhealthy watersheds, you're going to get really rotten water quality. So what about this article? This is one of the featured guys in it, Paul Kaemeyer, who's a producer out in Grand Junction. And the article's titled, This giant climate hotspot is robbing the West of its water, 2 degrees Celsius limit. And the whole article revolves around this image and that black box there in Western, in Colorado and Utah and Wyoming. And in particular, this big area, dark red, that since 1895 has warmed well over 2 degrees Celsius. The data set here, just for reference, is a data set done by NOAA called Incline Grid. That's fairly new. People really like it, and I've grown to appreciate its values. Here's a look at Montrose County in Colorado. You can see that degree trend. And the U.S. trend here in orange at about a degree Celsius. So this particular area is warming about 2.5 times the national average. And the article got into understanding or explaining what this means for people and challenges that Western Colorado and others in that hotspot are fair. Here's Paul again. He's a chance to interact with him. He grows alfalfa and grass. And they've experienced, as has everyone in the Colorado River Basin, CRB there, this ongoing 20-year drought with about a 20-foot decline in Colorado River flow. There's some talk in here about how 2018 was the tough year going back 70 years, and they only got about 10% of normal yield off. The article did not especially focus on 2020 because it was actually written much of it was written prior to this year, and they'd been sitting on it trying to find the right time to run it. But one of the outstanding things that happened this year was that on April 1, Lake Powell, we had almost 100% snowpack. And in a normal year, you might think that that would lead to something around 100% of runoff, maybe 85% to 115%, depending on sort of the year. But instead, we got 52%. And that's yet another one of these odd things that are going on with our climate. And article also talks about how it's just gotten harder and harder for the state of Colorado to deliver its compact water to the lower basin. And that compact water is part of a key provision in the Colorado River Compact in 1922. Okay, so with that introduction out of the way, here's a quick outline. Talk quickly about climate change, about some myths and the connection to the water cycle. I want to talk about the Colorado River at a broad scale overview, some of the hydrology and these reservoir levels, the current operating rules and the like. I'm then going to spend a whole bunch of time on what the science is telling us and why is this flow and almost 20% since the year 2000. I'm going to close talking about what water managers are doing, and then, of course, end with some concluding thoughts. To start, this T-shirt is mine. It was given me by someone. And literally, you can explain climate change in 5 quick points if you want. In the next slide, I'll show you 10 different areas where we've noted warming. It's not just air temperatures. It's everywhere. There's no explanation other than greenhouse gas emissions from humans that are causing. So I've looked at this. Well, frankly, over 200 years to understand the greenhouse effect, and there's no other credible explanation. Point three, guidelines point two, which is, hey, we've been again and again, and no one is ever finding that it's not us. Point four, it's bad, and about this after, you know, experienced crummy air quality here in Colorado and drought. And then point five, we can fix it. I think that's a little bit optimistic. We can handle it. We can deal with it if we're smart. I would argue we're not being particularly smart right now. So my point one was it's moving. And this is out of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Fifth Assessment Report, AR5, there down in the lower corner. And these are 10 different ways we can tell it's warming, one graph per way. And the upper one here is this land air surface area to talk about, but sea surface temperature is warming, marine air temperatures, sea level is rising, sea level because of melting glaciers plus what expands as it gets warmer. Arctic sea ice extent has gone way down. The mid-atmosphere, the troposphere up here in the upper right, is warming. The ocean heat content down to 2,000 feet is warming. The atmosphere is actually holding more moisture, this specific humidity chart here. Northern hemisphere snow is declining. Why not southern hemisphere? Well, there isn't actually much in the southern hemisphere. You got Africa, which is pretty far north, and South America, where you could actually get snow, tiny little sliver. So that's why we talk only about northern hemisphere. And then, of course, glaciers everywhere are melting. It's not just air temperature. There are tons of myths out there, and social media has frankly been awful about it because it's allowed the denial run with these awful ideas. And I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time, but this site by Skeptical Science is terrific, actually. And let me just pick out one or two. Let's talk right now. So it's snow, cold and snowing, right? Why is that? Somebody says, hey, we just hit a cold record. Why is that a myth? Well, we're always going to have winter. The Earth's tilted at 20°, and North Pole is in darkness 6 months a year. And as soon as it gets dark up there, it gets cold. And some of that cold is going to find its way down here, degrees north latitude, and we're still getting cold records. We just happen to set up now about four warm records for every one cold. And as the century unfolds, maybe by mid-century, you'll see 20 warm to one cold, and maybe end century, 50 warm records for one cold. But we can still set cold records. So I just want to make the point, out there on social media and find something that supports the idea that it's not warming, you'll find all kinds of stuff that sounds good, some of which is awful, but they're easy enough to get rid of, to dispel if you spend just a little bit of time. All right, and so I like change is water change. And this has been noted since the very first scientific studies. And even the first climate models back in the 1970s that scientists ran, that they noted water cycle would be enhanced. And so what happened is this big heat-driven water cycle, if you had energy, as we're currently doing by these greenhouse gases warming the planet, you're going to change where the precipitation is. So less to the south, more to the north. And that line, we think, is actually probably southern Colorado, although as the century unfolds, we'll probably move northerly. When air precipitates, we're going to see more rain and less snow, so the type of precipitation. We expect the intensity of precip to go up. And we expect to see more dry days, and that means longer droughts, and so the precipitation will change. Of course, as it warms, you're going to transition from soils and water bodies and more plant water use. One of the things I showed earlier was the idea that the water vapor in the atmosphere is going up, and it can go up at about 7% per degree Celsius. And sometimes we call that the atmospheric thirst. So the atmosphere wants to hold more moisture, and when it decides to get rid of it again, it does it in these very intense ways. In snowmelt basin-dominated areas, we're going to see earlier and runoff dates. The annual pattern of runoff, the hydrograph that is so important to us in the American West, shifts early. I don't work on water quality, but because water will be warmer, it facilitates these harmful algal blooms. And as water warms, it holds less oxygen. And even now, you'll hear the Colorado Department of Water asking people not to fish in summer hot days in the afternoons because it just for fish and they get stressed. And fires, more dust on snow, are all part of how the water cycle is going to change. And
Brad,
yes, I'm going to.
We're having issues hearing you. You're cutting in and out. And so I think I just wanted to let everyone know that we're trying to figure out a way to make it a little smoother, but if we miss something, I think so far we've been able to get the gist of what you're saying, but if we miss something, I may stop you and have you repeat.
Okay. Yeah, occasionally Zoom is popping up with an unstable internet on me, and I don't know what that's all about, but I'm at least vaguely aware. So this is...
Brad, we just had a suggestion, and it might be helpful if you turned your video off.
Sure. Yeah.
We'll try that. We can hear you and see your slides. We'll try that. Thanks, Brad.
Okay. Yeah. So this is a 2008 article in the nation's premier journal, Science, and the title is Stationarity Water Management. And it's written by a bunch of really well-known hydrologists, several of whom I'm going to talk about later in this presentation, including Millie there and Dennis Lettenmeyer. And in this article, they talk about how because the water cycle is changing and that water resources planning uses the past climate as a guide to the future, it makes it more difficult to all the past statistics of water for planning. And this includes things like culverts under roads and curbs on things like dams and pipelines and ditches. It makes all that less certain, and it becomes more less certain, if you will, as the century unfolds. It means that both supply and demand will change. It means that we need to rethink how we manage existing projects. And it means that any new water project will have significant uncertainty associated with it. So here's an image on that just kind of sets the stage for the Colorado. And this gets me out of my whole climate change part of the talk. And I just want to pause for a sec. Questions on sort of that whole climate change part about, do we know it's happening? Where is it happening? What's it mean for water manager, that climate part of the art of the art of the art? Are there any questions?
I have a question.
Go ahead,
Luke.
My name's Lucas. I'm a first year, by the way. Dr. Patterson invited me to come join this. And so what are some of the reasons maybe that there was such a low runoff from a normal snowpack?
Oh, man, great, great question. So if you really want to know, I put out almost a 30-tweet thread on this back in June. And my tweet thread was based on information from the Colorado Basin River Forecast Center. And here's sort of the gist of what was in that. So one, April was really dry, and we don't often just switch into a super dry April. Then March and June were not only dry, but really warm. So you had 3 months in there that were either dry or warm or both. That's part of it. Another part of it is soil moisture from the previous year was low. And one of the things we've discovered, I would argue, fairly recently is that that soil moisture is super important because effectively, before runoff occurs, you have to moisture. So soil, if you will, on. So those are at least a few of the factors that we think went into this year's reduction in runoff. And I'll bet some good science is being done already on it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Other questions?
Student out there. I'm not seeing any, Brad. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. All right. So here's just a quick map. The Colorado River Basin, all those arrows indicate major diversions out. And if you look, those diversions go into the Front Range of Colorado. They go to Santa Fe and Albuquerque. They go uphill in Arizona to Phoenix and Tucson. They go out of the basin into Los Angeles and San Diego, where it's roughly 25% of their water supply. They go uphill into Las Vegas, and Las Vegas is 90% on Colorado River water with 2 million people. Even into Salt Lake, and believe it or not, Cheyenne, Wyoming gets Colorado River water via exchange in an odd way. So it goes throughout the West. The basin here, you can see it's an upper and lower basin. There are 7 states and 2 nations, 29 tribes. It's actually a pretty small river. It's only the size of the Hudson. The annual flow is close to 15 million acres. And the worst drought in the gauge record started in the year 2000. It's roughly 12.7 million acre feet. There are 40 million people, every major city in the American Southwest, a whole bunch of irrigated acres, especially down here. The southern portion of the basin, where you can see American Canal into the Imperial Valley near Yuma, and a bunch of ag actually in central Arizona as well. So there are still projects people want to put in place, like a Lake Powell pipeline from over to St. George. And I'll also note at the very bottom here is this little ribbon of river that in theory runs into the Gulf of California. And it hasn't run reliably to the ocean in about the last 40 years. Take every last drop. So this image here just sets the stage for the drought. And this 4-panel plot on the upper right shows the contents of both reservoirs. Originally only Lake Mead, then Lake Powell fills. You have both reservoirs full for a while. And then in the year 2000, we have this unprecedented drop and the reservoirs have not recovered and are now about 50% full. We have this in panel B, upper basin natural flows. Those are flows unimpaired by human. Lee's Ferry, dividing line between the upper basin and the lower basin. We have this long-term decline, which is in some ways artificial because it's driven by these really record-setting flows in the early part of the 20th century. But clearly these more recent flows, what Overpeck and I call the hot drought, are different than anything we've seen in the record. Upper basin precip is flat over the last almost 100 years. And then upper basin temperatures with this really strong rise, which is what we see worldwide. And this image on the left is just a blow up of the right there. Central Arizona Project is key to any discussion about the Colorado River. It was a longtime desire of Arizona to build this project to take water from the river itself and pump it into their areas of population, including Phoenix and Tucson. It's the equivalent of really big projects in California. It cost $4.5 billion. President Carter actually tried to kill it, but it came back. It's over 300 miles, 3,000 vertical feet all the way down into Tucson, uses a large amount of power. And the reason I mention it, I'm going to get back to this later, but it's so important because it leads to this overuse in the lower basin. And there's a little bit of a personal story here I'll tell. I actually have not one, but two relatives in this photograph. This was the bill signing in 1968 when Congress approved federal funds to build the Central Arizona Project. You see President Lyndon Johnson there seated with Senator Carl Hayden, a representative from, or a senator from Arizona, President Johnson's wife, Lady Bird Johnson. And then the far right, the tall guy there is my father. My wife sometimes says the guy with the big ears. And then my uncle, believe it or not, is also in this picture, Stuart Udall here, just behind Carl Hayden. At the time, my father was a representative from Arizona and fought for this water project. And his brother, Stuart, there was Secretary of the Interior. And the quote here is from the Reclamation Commissioner Strauss in 1948. He said, every drop of water in the Colorado River will be utilized. The Colorado will be the first major river in the world of complete utilization. The time of complete utilization will come much sooner than anyone now believes possible. And that leads us to this image produced as part of the basin study in 2012. And Strauss's thought there back in the 1940s comes true because the red line with water use and the blue line with water supply actually cross in the early 2000s. And you can see these projected water demands and water supplies continue to diverge, at least in fuzzy ways, out as the 21st century unfolds. This image here comes from Reclamation, and it's all about what we call the structural deficit. It's not something built in concrete, but some days it feels like it is, because once water users get a hold of water, it's very hard to get them to cut back. And effectively, the math is really simple at the largest reservoir in the United States, Lake Mead. 9 million acre feet goes in or not. 10.2 million acre feet goes out, and you have a net loss to Lake Mead every year of 1.2 million acre feet. How can they get away with doing this? Well, if you start with full reservoirs, you can do it for a number of years before you get into real problems. And that's actually been what we've seen since the year 2000 when these flows declined on the river. All right, so I've jumped to a whole bunch of science, and I've got, I don't know, five or six papers I want to talk about. And they, most of these papers date to roughly 2015 or 2016. This paper by Connie Woodhouse, University of Arizona, and co-authors. And what Connie found here, and actually the title kind of says it all, increasing influence of air temperature on Upper Colorado River stream flow. And what Connie found was that normally we think about precipitation driving river flows, right? It should be the key driver. But she said temperature can actually be a major flow driver. And she also said that since 1988, flows have been less than expected in the Colorado River, given winter precip, and that warm temperatures have exacerbated modest precipitation deficits in the millennium drought, the term we use for the drought since 2000. And this image, and it's basically easy just to look at those bars, the colored bars. The blue and green bars are years in which you get more runoff than expected for a given amount of precipitation, no matter if the precipitation's high or low. And the only difference between green and blue is the blue is if the precipitation is lower than normal and green is higher than normal, but they're actually getting good for a given amount of sun stuff than you should. And then the peach and red bars are just the inverse, years in which for a given amount of precipitation from October to April, you get less runoff. And if you look at this on the right side, guess what? You got a whole bunch of those purple and peach colored bars, and they started roughly about 1988, hence the findings here of this paper by Connie and co-authors. In 2017, I wrote a paper with Jonathan Overpeck, and our title was The 21st Century Colorado River Implications for the Future. And what we did was contrast the 1950 dry drought, which we call a drought because you lack precipitation, with the what we call the 2000s hot drought. And we said, if you really look at the precipitation from 2000 to 2014, you can't explain the entire flow loss. And you can roughly explain two-thirds of it. And so you have to invoke something else. What's that something else? It's temperature. And so temperature increases explain the remainder, that remaining one-third. And why? Because we have more evaporation. You have a thirstier atmosphere that drives and temperature losses at about 6%, roughly a third of the overall roughly 20% decline. And if you extrapolate out to 2050 and 2100, based on what we know about temperatures, you could expect to see roughly 20% decline and by 2050 and 35% decline by 2035 if precipitation stays the same. The kind of put this vapor pressure deficit and soil moisture in context, and this is actually almost perfect for the earlier question about runoff this year. So on the left, we have vapor pressure deficit. That's water vapor pressure deficit, or the amount of water that the atmosphere could hold that it's not holding. And this is August 20. And basically, these are record-setting numbers for this particular data set, which goes back to 1979. And on the right, back to 1901, these are soil moisture deficits or ranks. And you can see these dark browns are, you know, the first or second or fifth worst all the way back to 1901. Just kind of indicative of experiencing. So here's another paper that I did with Lettenmeyer. I mentioned him earlier with his student, Mu Shao, on the causes of declining Colorado River stream flows. And this was a super simple study to do. We took a hydrology model that's driven by four variables. What it does is reproduce the flow of the Colorado River using maximum temperature, minimum temperature, precipitation, and wind. Those variables are daily going back almost 100 years. You run it first time and you tweak a lot of knobs and you get something that looks pretty much like Colorado River flow. And then because it's a model, you can take out the warming that's occurred and rerun it and see what happens. And basically, if you take the warming out, you get a whole lot of water back. And if you do the math on it, basically, we said that 50% of the decline is due to these higher temperatures, and it's because all kinds of evaporation have been enhanced, and that the remaining 50% of the decline is because of changing precipitation patterns. And in this particular data set, the precipitation actually moved out of Colorado, and its productive basins here shown in green and blue, over into these less productive basins in Utah. Mega drought is a concept that people are talking about a lot, and another slide is going to get more at the heart of this, but this study was done, I want to say about 2015, and basically what these scientists said is that in the 20th century or the latter part of the 20th century, this idea that we might get multi-decadal mega drought, that's mega drought and multi-decadal go together, that at the end of the 21st century, that risk goes through the roof. And you can see it here based on these bars using three different measures of soil moisture, hence the three different bars, but roughly 10% late 20th century chance of mega drought and roughly 80% end of 21st century. And interestingly enough, this year in April, this brand new paper came out that actually said we've actually now entered a mega drought. A bunch of super well-known scientists effectively, what they say is that this is the second driest 19-year period since 800 AD, measured by soil moisture. And it's caused both by natural variability and this anthropogenic warming and hence drying. And it's about 50% due to humans. Without these warmer temperatures, it'd actually be quite modest. And these images actually show you an idea of sort of the breadth of this this mega drought relative to four other periods that they looked at. And they're just sort of different images here. But this is brand new this year. Also new this year is a paper that built upon the paper that Overpeck and I did, and even the paper with Lettenmeyer. It was in Science. Title is Colorado River Flow Dwindles as Warming-Driven Loss of Reflective Snow Energizes Evaporation. And what Chris Milley and his co-author did was try and come up with a number for how much the flow of the river declines per degree Celsius warming. And that's this answer here, minus 9.3% flow loss per degree Celsius. And if you only look at potential temperatures by mid-century, you end up with 14 to 26% under low greenhouse gas emissions and roughly 20 to 30% under high greenhouse gas emissions. It's right in the ballpark of what Overpeck and I suggested. And if you factor in potential precipitation increases, maybe some of that gets buffered. So maybe you don't lose any water, but you still have what happens on the worst side, actually, is if you lose precipitation, these numbers actually get worse, the minus 24% or minus 40% or worse. And effectively what Chris and Krista say here is that as this snow melts earlier in the year, the land surface gets darker, it absorbs more heat, it causes more evapotranspiration by plants, evaporation and elsewhere. It's basically, it says what everyone else has said, but in a it's wrapped up in a really nice modeled study. This is a commentary that I did earlier this year that accompanied another paper, and we basically said this drought we're having right now really isn't a drought. We need a new term. That term is aridification. Many others have used this framing. And in this particular case, the commentary was written for a aridification finding in the Missouri River Basin, actually. So it's not just the American Southwest, it's occurring elsewhere. And same message, small increases in evapotranspiration leads to large decreases in runoff. This is a little older paper, but talks about how dust on snow, and the image here is from the San Juans in the southwestern portion of Colorado, dirty snow in the spring, can cause earlier snow melt up to three weeks, to actually cause a reduction in flow loss too of about 5%. This dust is actually coming from disturbed landscapes in Utah and northern Arizona, and is this often associated with drought. When it's dry in those areas, you have less vegetation, the soil's less locked down, and it's easier for these spring, especially windstorms, to lift that dust and move it.
Brad, let's stop there.
Okay.
You went through a lot of material there.
Lots and lots of material.
And so one question I have, and since I'm in charge, I get to ask it first, and that is, you use the term aridification rather than drought. Can you, a little more simply to me, explain what the difference is?
Sure. So aridification is this long-term drying. Now, drought implies a temporary condition. Aridification is a term we're trying to use to imply a permanent change, a drying of the landscape. And if aridification went on long enough in certain climates, you'd end up. But it doesn't necessarily mean a desertification, but it could very well mean a change in plants that grow. It might not necessarily mean any change in precipitation, but because you have this bigger evaporative demand, there's less for humans and nature to utilize. So that's probably my best
answer.
That's
very helpful. Thank you. Any of the other students have questions for Brad while we're at a stopping point here? Johanna, go ahead.
I'm just interested in understanding kind of the hydrologic change that would result from the drying. Would it cause kind of peakier flows in the summer because you said like rain doesn't occur as often, but when it does occur, it becomes or it occurs at higher magnitude? Or would it be less peakier because of that low soil moisture that takes down a lot of the water?
You know, I think the answer to your question might depend on where you're talking about in the basin. So for example, because of these intense precip events you might see in the summer, you know, if you're in the lower basin in Arizona, I mean, you could see flash flooding of the likes we haven't seen before. In the upper basin, we tend not to see that kind of summer precip, and the hydrologic cycle just is shifting earlier and basically lower runoff later in the year. So I guess it kind of, that's a regionally dependent question or answer.
Jennifer, this is Devin Richardson. I'm not actually a CSU student, but just remember the public and enjoying these conversations. But quick question for you, Brad. I work a lot with regulatory agencies, and so you're saying that, in saying that we are seeing an ultimate and somewhat of a universal, I guess you say, Western change to our water flows, how are you seeing, and maybe Jennifer, you can speak to this as well, but how are you seeing that the regulatory folks, as well as those that are working through the Colorado River Compact, taking any of this information and applying it for long-term sustainability as opposed to maybe immediate fixes, so to speak? Is that something that I can't imagine it's happening very rapidly, but how is this being taken to heart with those folks from a standpoint of a long-term sustainability aspect in making these ultimate potential changes that we need to make from a standpoint of climate change?
I'm going to actually answer that in my remaining slides.
Okay.
And it's more on the water. My supply side than the water, because your question's broad enough to encompass both, and I don't have great answers for you in the water quality, but on the water supply side, I will get to that.
Okay, thank you very much. Sorry to
how policy incorporates science. That's good. Anyone else? All right, Brad, go ahead.
So I'm actually going to skip this. This just refers back to that same Cara Sun article just about this is the biggest fire season in Colorado history. And if you haven't learned anything from my talk, this dryness and heat is clearly and just going to leave it at that and give them the move on here. All right, so this is Jennifer's question, right? This is the answer to Jennifer's question right here. Basically, there's a paper here that the Colorado River Research Group put out called "When Is a Drought Not a Drought? Drought Aridification in the New Normal?" And it gets to the answer that I gave. Why are we using this term and what's it mean? So I'll move on. Here's a look at climate model projections out of 39 different global models, and you can see the middle 50% of them have warming of 3 to 5 Celsius. And the one thing I want everybody on this Zoom to understand is that when people talk about worldwide warming, it's going to warm a lot more here. Why? Because that worldwide warming average includes the ocean, which is 70% of the planet, and it will warm a lot less because it has this huge thermal mass. And when you get in the middle of continents, that global average number, you're going to have to increase it significantly to understand what's actually going to happen. That's a lot of warming. And here's a look at drying and precipitation and all that hatching are areas that we're kind of uncertain about what goes on. And the colors here indicate you can't actually see Colorado, but sort of a somewhere in the middle of Colorado, probably a drying to the south and a wetting to the north. And I'll note that runoff is not precipitation again, right? You only get runoff after plants get a crack at it, the soil gets a crack at it. And so even under increased precipitation with significant warming, you would see less runoff. All right, so now to the question of what are water managers doing about this? So the current water management agreements, there's a whole bunch of them. They expire in 2026. The negotiations are set to start this year. There are all these really difficult problems, including overuse in the lower basin, much driven by the Central Arizona Project. There are issues around the Colorado River Compact and its delivery obligation, so-called delivery obligation, that says every 10 running years, the upper basin shall not cause the flow to decline below 75 million acre feet. The upper basin maintains, well, if it's climate change that's caused the flow to decline, they're off the hook. And there's some real validity, actually, to this. And, of course, in 1922, no one thought anything about climate change, even though scientists were aware of the greenhouse gas effect. And these declining flows, obviously, are part of the problem. There are 7 states and 29 tribes, Mexico, the federal government, and the solutions are not at all clear. Clearly, we need some reductions in lower basin demand because of that structural deficit. There'll be a role for the tribes. And the image here is an agreement that was signed in 2019 that I'll get into in just a second, called the Drought Contingency Plan. And the major agreement that's in place right now was signed in 2007. At the time, Secretary Gail Norton in the Bush administration basically said, hey, the reservoirs have dropped. See where that red arrow is? She jumped in 2005 and said, hey, 7 basin states, you have no plan for dealing with empty reservoirs. Please put one in place soon or I will. And in 2 short years, huge environmental impact statement was done. And basically half of the structural deficit was dealt with in sort of a temporary way. That decision is, again, to last through 2026. And there are these very complicated rules that deal with Lakes Powell and Lakes Mead and how much water one releases to the other. And around 2012, 5 years later, because the reservoirs hadn't increased, the lower basin states especially got nervous and started an effort that took roughly 7 years called drought contingency planning. And they came up with the DCP that was signed in 2019. And here's the DCP, some information on it. They actually made some really hard decisions here. And one of the things I didn't mention about the Central Arizona Project, which is super important, in 1968, in order to get the state of California to sign on to federal funding for the Central Arizona Project, the state of Arizona agreed to be first in line to take shortages if there were a lack of water for all lower basin needs. And that has put Arizona in a very difficult position and led to their, of course, taking the lead and the heat on much of the discussions around both the 2007 agreement and this newer 2019 agreement. And the DCP was hard fought and again took 7 years. I don't think anybody thought it would take that long. But basically around 2012, the parties in the basin realized that the rules put in place in 2007 were not nearly stringent enough to avert some kind of catastrophe. And so thankfully the lower basin states got together and everybody, I would argue, gave a little bit, including the state of California, including key critical Indian tribes in Arizona. There was a lot of give and take, and for the most part, I would tell you people in the basin, especially the lower basin, more so than the upper basin, were happy about that agreement. But it's only temporary, and I'll just make the point that these low reservoir levels really make the risk of basically what I call catastrophic shortages too high for water managers to like. Again, 25% of that water goes into Southern California, and it's an important part of their water supplies because California is subject to serious droughts that are actually somewhat independent of the Colorado River droughts. And this image just quickly shows the difference between the 2007 guidelines and what happened in 2019 in the DCP, the Drought Contingency Plan's additions. And Lake Mead elevations are here on the left. As Lake Mead declines, these shortages go into place measured by the, in this case in 2007, this sort of gray area. And you can see the shortage amounts on the y-axis. And you can see how DCP, these shortages actually occur at higher reservoir levels, 1090 versus 1075. And then the size or the area of those two colors indicate how much water DCP adds. And it actually doubles the reductions that occur in the lower basin as reservoir levels drop. And so what's the DCP do? It buys us some time. It still leaves hard decisions for 2026. It doesn't solve the structural deficit. I mean, if you want to throw rocks at it, it wasn't very transparent. I say 4 years here, but actually it's longer than that. There was a bunch of modeling and things that went on that nobody really got to see. There's issues with an environmental area called the Salton Sea in California. There are problems with people effectively taking loans for these shortages, and they're not really shortages, they're like loans. And the Upper Basin wasn't really happy because they weren't included very much in it. The Upper Basin was allowed to get what's called a demand management pool in Lake Powell to at least be able to study it. And let me, again, in response to that question, what are the states doing? I would tell you the state of Colorado is way out ahead of the other four Upper Basin states, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico. And it's been actively studying something called demand management, which is how through voluntary, compensated, temporary reductions in water use, the state of Colorado would continue to meet its Colorado River Compact obligations. This is a super complicated area. I'm not by any means an expert on it. Once you start taking water out of especially agriculture, you have all these different on-farm and off-farm impacts. You've got local economic impacts. And there have been a number of different pilot projects over the years to try and look at what it might look like to pay especially farmers on the West Slope not to use water. And this is a July 2020 document that came out of the Colorado Water Conservation Board. I'm almost done. So these are a bunch of ideas for, how you might renegotiate in 2026. Clearly it needs to be open and inclusive with modeling tools and a big environmental impact statement. We need this solution to the structural deficit. We really need to plan for extended low flows. We can hope they don't happen, but the science tells us there's a pretty good likelihood that we're going to see some really low extended flows. We need to revisit all of these longstanding assumptions about how we manage the river, including this 1968 law that forces Arizona to bear the brunt of the entire structural deficit. We need to talk again about that 75 million acre foot delivery. Some people call it obligation. Some people don't like that term. Requires the upper basin to deliver water to the lower basin. We need to think about the worst. We need to talk about new diversions because some people want to have new diversions. I think you cannot cut the Central Arizona Project to zero. It's a large portion of the water that gets used in Phoenix. In Tucson, at the end of the Cap Canal, they have no surface water. That entire town of 1 million people has grown up on groundwater. And while there's lots of groundwater under Tucson, it is not infinite. And under any equitable solution, no matter what happened in 1968, you cannot cut that canal to zero. Under, you know, any sort of drought contingencies that I can foresee. Upper Basin needs to think about using its demand management account so that it has more control over its destiny. And that last bullet point there, just the politics are really dicey, I have to say. So let me close here and just say climate change is already impacting this basin. For sure, temperatures are impacting. The slight declines in precipitation that we have seen in one scientific study have been attributed to human causes, but that only one study. And I didn't talk about that study. I'm happy to take a question on it. And if that worrisome. These impacts are going to get worse. The term new normal, I don't like. Maybe new abnormal is better. But we're going to be looking at a moving target as it warms through the 21st century. The proper term is aridification, not drought. You should plan on it being hotter everywhere, changing runoff patterns, more weather variability, both within the year, like these two snowstorms we've had. I mean, we've had a foot of snow twice here in Boulder. I wish we had a lot more just this fall. Very odd. There's this big flow reduction risk. We even have, oddly, flood risk in a few cases, although it's not the major risk we're going to deal with in the basin. Higher water temperatures and water quality are something that need to come on people's radar screens. And of course, and I put that in there a lot before. This is a slide that's 6 months old, so predates this fire season. And, you know, my take to the question of what water managers are doing, they understand these problems, but we're far from solutions. And let me stop there.
Brad, go ahead and turn your camera on and take off your screen. That really helped a lot. You only faded out a couple times.
Okay.
So that worked out very, very well. And then let me turn to the students and see if, first of all, students have any questions before I open it up to everybody else. One of the things we were trying to do in this class is talk about law.